or interests to challenge power. Our guest today is Henri Giroux. He's a prominent public intellectual, a prolific writer, and political commentator. He's written many books, including Neoliberalism's War on Higher Education and America at War with Itself. He teaches at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, where he gave this lecture.
With the rise of Donald Trump to the office of President of the United States, politics has descended like never before to the theater of the absurd. Unbridled anti-intellectualism, deception, and vindictive chaos offer the rhetorical tools for repeating elements of a morally reprehensible past in the guise of making America great again. Advancing an aggressively alarmist agenda, boasted by alternative facts, the Trump administration has unleashed a type of anti-politics that unburdens people of any responsibility to challenge, let alone collectively transform, the fundamental precepts of a society torn asunder by blatant misogyny, massive inequality, open bigotry, and violence against immigrants, Muslims, and poor minorities of color. In the new age of Trump, justice becomes the enemy of democratic leadership, and the capacity to name this a collectively agreed upon reality recedes with each assertion of fakery in infinite repetition. When evidence, science, and reason are purged of their legitimacy, politics capitulates to venomous ideals. Policies and practices emerge that one associates with a totalitarian past. Cast into a political, existential, and ethical crisis in which it now finds itself immersed, America mimics what I call a failed state, as the credibility of its democratic institutions and the trustworthiness of its leadership are called into question on the global stage. Despite the populist posturing, Trump's contempt of democratic processes is matched by his commitment to the market and economic policies that favor the financial elite. In short, as the Washington Post observed, Trump is a unique threat to democracy and a triumph for the forces of activism, racism, and misogyny. Trump's ascendancy in politics has made visible a plague of deep-seated civic illiteracy, a corrupt political system, and a contempt for reason that has been decades in the making. It also points to the withering of civic attachments, the decline of public life, and the use of violence and fear to shock and numb everyday people. Galvanizing his base of true believers in post-election rallies, the country witnesses how politics is transformed into a spectacle of fear, divisions, and disinformation. Under President Trump, the scourge of mid-20th century authoritarianism has returned, not only in the menacing plague of populist rallies, fear-mongering, hate, and humiliations, but also in an emboldened culture of war, militarization, and the violence that looms over society like a rising storm. The reality of Trump's election may be the most momentous development of the age because of its enormity and the shock it has produced. The whole world is watching, pondering how such a dreadful event could have happened. How have we arrived here? Albert Camus understood this threat well. He warned us that how the plague of authoritarianism can reappear in updated forms. For Camus, the disease of fascism could only be fought with the antibody of consciousness, one that embraced the past as a way of protecting the present and the future. The words that form the concluding paragraph of his book, The Plague, are as relevant today as they were when they were written more than a half century ago. Camus writes, as he listened to the cries of joy rising from the town, Rieu remembered that such joy is always imperiled. He knew what those jubilant crowds did not know, but could have learned from books, that the plague bacillus never dies or disappears for good. that it can lie dormant for years and years in furniture and linen chest, that it bides its time in bedrooms and cellars and trunks and bookshelves, and perhaps the day would come when, for the bane and the enlightening of men, it would rouse up its rats again and send them forth to die in a happy city. What follows is an attempt to assert the significance of historical memory as fundamental to the preservation of a democracy in the face of an unprecedented shift towards authoritarianism. Reviving the memory of a dystopian past strikingly represented in Orwell and Huxley's fiction is a way to understand, and perhaps one of the few ways left for us to fully grasp, the present descent of the United States into an authoritarian nightmare. Focusing on their engagement with authoritarian visions, language, truth, and lies offers a critical arsenal of defense against the Trump era, an era of tweets, news fakery, and the more generalized and more lethal attacks on reason, on science, on liberal modernity. I first want to begin with Orwell. Before we credit Trump with using his great novel as a code book, it is actually the case that George Orwell's terrifying vision of a totalitarian society has been a waking dream in the United States for many years. For instance, 1984 provided a stunningly prophetic image of the totalitarian machinery of the surveillance state that was brought to life in 2013 through Edward Snowden's exposure of the mass spying conducted by the United States National Security Agency. Orwell's genius was not limited to this predictive capacity alone. In addition, his fiction explores how modern democratic populations are won over by authoritarian ideologies and rituals, revealing how language specifically functioned in the service of deception, abuse, and violence. He warned in exquisite and alarming detail how, quote, totalitarian practice becomes internalized in totalitarian thinking. For Orwell, the mind-controlling totalitarian state took as its first priority a war against what he called thought crimes, nullifying oppositions to its authority not simply by controlling access to information, but by undermining the very basis in which critique is challenged and could be waged and communicated. Orwell illustrated his point by providing examples of language that weakened the critical formative culture necessary for producing thinking citizens central to any healthy democracy, and in recognizing how language fundamentally structures as much as it expresses thought, Orwell made clear how language could be distorted and circulated to function in the service of violence, deceit, and misuse, and in doing so, utterly collapsed the distinction between good and evil, truth and lies. According to Orwell, totalitarian power drained meaning of any substance by turning language against itself, exemplified through his ministry of truth, which dissolved politics into pathology by promoting such slogans as war is peace, freedom is slavery, and ignorance is strength. Hannah Arendt added theoretical weight to Orwell's fictional nightmare by arguing that totalitarianism begins with a contempt for critical thought, and that the foundation for authoritarianism lies in a kind of mass thoughtlessness in which citizenry is deprived, quote, not only of its capacity to act, but also of its capacity to think and to judge. The intersection, if not merger, of popular culture and American politics was evident in the frenzied media circus that took place after Trump assumed the presidency, a fact not lost on the American public. Orwell's novel, 1984, surged as the number one bestseller on Amazon, both in the United States and in Canada. This followed two significant political events. First, Kellyanne Conway, Trump's advisor, in a move reminiscent of the linguistic inventions of Orwell's Ministry of Truth, coined the term alternative facts to justify why Press Secretary Sean Spicer lied in advancing disproved claims about the size of Trump's inauguration crowd. The concept of alternative facts, or more precisely what should be called outright lies, is an updated term of what Orwell called doublethink, in which people blindly accept contradictory ideas or allow truth to be subverted in the name of unquestioned common sense. Second, almost within hours of his presidency, Trump penned a series of executive orders that compelled Adam Gopnik, a writer for The New Yorker, to rethink the relevance of Orwell's book, quote, because the single most striking thing about Trump's strange first few weeks is how primitive, atavistic, and uncomplicatedly brutal Trump's brand of authoritarianism is turning out to be. Unfortunately, the machinery of remolding, manipulation, and distortion has gained enormous traction at the present under the Trump administration. In this Orwellian universe, there are only winners and losers. And under such circumstances, greed, vengeance, and gratuitous cruelty aren't wrong, but are legitimate motivations for political behavior. This is a discourse that reinforces a future in which totalitarianisms thrive and democracies die. As Orwell often remarked, historical memory is dangerous to authoritarian regimes because it has the power to question the past and reveal it as a site of injustice. Currently, Orwell's machinery of organized forgetting is now reinforced by a burgeoning landscape of mega malls and theme parks, media-driven displays of violence, and a culture of consumerism, self-interest, and infantilizing spectacles for those who can afford participation. For the rest, the ongoing financial starvation and evisceration of public schools and public universities ensures that the lesson of history are neutered or displaced altogether by an instrumentalist curriculum whose hallmark is job-ready skills. In Orwell's Ministry of Truth, it's a crime to read history against the grain. In fact, history is falsified so as to render it useless as a crucial pedagogical practice, both for understanding the conditions that shape the present and for remembering what should never be forgotten. As Orwell makes clear, this is precisely why tyrants consider historical memory dangerous. History can readily be put to use in identifying present-day abuses of power and corruption. The Trump administration offered a pointed example of this Orwellian principle when it issued a statement regarding the observance of International Holocaust Remembrance Day. In the statement, the White House refused to mention its Jewish victims, thus erasing them from a monstrous act directed against an entire people. Politico reported that the official White House statement drew widespread criticism for overlooking the Jews' suffering and was cheered by neo-Nazi websites such as the Daily Stormer. Accounts of these events read like passages out of Orwell's 1984 and speak to what historian Timothy Snyder calls the Trump administration's efforts to look to authoritarian regimes of the 1930s as potential models. This act of erasure is but another example of the willingness of the Trump administration to empty language of any meaning, a practice that constitutes a flight from historical memory, ethics, justice, and social responsibility. And under such circumstances, government takes on the workings of a disimagination machine, characterized by another disregard for truth, and often accompanied, as in Trump's case, by primitive schoolyard taunts and threats. In this instance, Orwell's ignorance is strength materializes in the Trump administration's weaponized attempt to not only rewrite history, but to obliterate it. Trump's contemptuous and boisterous claim that he loves the uneducated and his willingness to act on the assertion that by flooding the media and the American public with an endless proliferation of peddled falsehoods reveal his contempt for intellect, reason, and truth. As the master of phony stories, Trump is not only at war with historical remembrance, science, and rationality, he also wages a demolition campaign against democratic ideals by unapologetically embracing humiliation, racism, and exclusion for those he labels as criminals, terrorists, and losers, categories now equated with Muslims, Mexicans, women, the disabled, and the list only grows. Orwell's point about duplicitous language was that all governments lie. The rhetorical manipulation, definitive of Orwellian language, is not distinctive to the Trump administration, though it has taken on an unapologetic register in redefining it and deploying it with reckless abandon. The draconian use of lies, propaganda, misinformation, and deploying it with reckless abandon, it seems to me, has a long legacy in the United States, with other recent examples evident under the presidency of George W. Bush. Under the Bush-Cheney administration, for example, doublethink and doublespeak became normalized as state-sponsored torture was shamelessly renamed as enhanced interrogation. Barbaric state practices, such as sending prisoners to countries where there were no limits on torture, were framed in the innocuous language of rendition. Such language made a mockery of policy discourse and eroded public engagement. It also contributed to the transformation of institutions that were meant to limit human suffering and protect citizens from the excesses of the market and state violence into something like their opposite. The attack on reason, on dissent and truth, finds its Orwellian apogee in Team Trump's endless proliferation of lies, including claims that China is responsible for climate change. Former President Obama was not born in the United States, and voter fraud prevented Trump from winning the popular vote for the presidency. Such lies, big and small, don't function simply as mystification. They offer justification for aggressive immigration crackdowns, for effectively silencing the EPA, and for upending Obamacare. Too often, the relentless fabrications serve to direct the press, focusing their energies on exposing the untrustworthiness of the person and not on the symbolic, legal, and material violence that such pronouncements and harsh policies invariably unleash. Allow me to underscore one more striking example. In moments that speak to an alarming flight for moral and social responsibility, Trump has adopted terms strongly affiliated with the legacy of anti-Semitism and Nazi ideology. For example, historian Susan Dunn refers to the use of his phrase, America First, as a sulfurous expression connected historically to the name of the isolationist, defeatist, anti-Semitic national organization that urged the United States to appease Adolf Hitler. It is also associated with its most powerful advocate, Charles Lindbergh, a notorious anti-Semite who once declared that America's greatest internal threat came from Jews who posed a danger to the United States because of their, quote, large ownership and influence in motion pictures, our press, the radio, and our government. And though Trump denies that he gives a platform to neo-Nazi groups, the shocking uptake in bomb threats to dozens of Jewish community centers across the United States can hardly be said to be accidental or coincidental. Once he was elected president, Trump took ownership of the notion of fake news, inverting its original uses as a critique of his perpetual lying and redeploying it as a pejorative label aimed at journalists who criticized his policies. Even Trump's inaugural address was filled with lies about rising crime rates and the claim that of unchecked carnage in America, though crime rates are at historical lows. His blatant disregard for the truth reached another high point soon afterwards with his nonsensical and false claim that leaks involving his national security advisor were real, but the news about them was fake. Figure that one out. Trump's penchant for lying and his irrepressible urge to tell them are more than what Gopnik calls Big Brother crude, the expression of a pure raging authoritarian id. They also speak to an effort to undermine freedom of speech and truthfulness as core democratic values. Trump's endless threats, fabrications, outrages, orchestrated chaos produced with dizzying velocity also points to a strategy for asserting power while encouraging, if not emboldening, his followers to think the unthinkable, ethically and politically. While it may be true that all administrations lie, what is unique to the Trump administration, as Charles Sykes, a former conservative radio host, no less, observes, quote, is an attack on credibility itself. Echoes of earlier authoritarian societies are not only audible, in Trump's falsehoods, petulance, and crudeness, but also in his slash and burn policies and his less discussed embrace of white supremacy. For example, his racism was on full display in the issuance of an executive order banning citizens from 7 Muslim-majority countries, Iran, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Somalia, Sudan, and Libya. The conditions permitting such an executive order to be thinkable, let alone entered into policy, not only signals a society that has stopped questioning itself, but points to the embrace of a form of social engineering that is once again being constructed around an imagined assault that legitimates a form of state-sponsored racial and religious purging, driven by an attempt to create a white Christian nation governed by biblical values. Racial cleansing based on a generalized notion of identity echoes the sordid principles of earlier policies of prohibition and eventual extermination that we saw in past regimes that gave birth to the unimaginable horrors and intolerable acts of mass violence. This is not to suggest that Trump's immigration policies has risen as yet to the level of genocided vitriol and sordid extermination policies of totalitarian regimes that gave birth to unimaginable horrors and intolerable acts of violence. But it is to suggest that they contain elements of a past totalitarianism that heralds a possible model for the future. What I am arguing is that this form of radical exclusion based on the denigration of Islam as a closed and timeless culture marks a terrifying entry into a political experience that suggests that the older elements of totalitarianism are crystallizing in new forms. There can be little doubt about the ideological direction of the Trump administration, given his appointment of billionaires, generals, white supremacists, representatives of the corporate elite, and the general incompetence to the highest level of government. Public spheres that once offered at least a glimmer of progressive ideas, enlightened social policies, non-commodified values, and critical dialogue and exchange have and will be increasingly commercialized or replaced by private spaces and corporate settings whose ultimate fidelity is to increasing profit margins. We are witnessing under this administration, what we are witnessing is more than an aesthetics of vulgarity, as the mainstream media sometimes suggests. Instead, we are observing a politics fueled by a market-driven view of society that has turned its back on the idea that social values, public trust, and communal relations are fundamental to a democratic society. It is to Orwell's credit that in his dystopian view of society, he opened the door for all to see a nightmarish future in which everyday life becomes harsh, an object of state surveillance and control, a society in which the slogan, ignorance becomes strength, morphs into a guiding principle of the highest levels of government, mainstream media, education, and popular culture. Aldous Huxley's Brave New World offers a very different and no less critical register to the landscape of state oppression, one that is especially relevant with the rise of Trump to the presidency of the United States. Huxley believed that social control and the propagation of ignorance could be introduced by those in power through a vast machinery of what he called manufactured needs, desires, and identifications. Accordingly, the real drugs of a controlled society and social planning were to be found in a culture that offers up immediate pleasure, sensationalism, and gratification. This new mode of persuasion seduced people into chasing commodities and infantilized them through the mass production of easily digestible entertainment, mass rallies, and a politics of distraction that dampened, if not obliterated, sometimes the very possibility of thinking itself. If Orwell's image is the stuff of government oppression, as he puts it, a boot stamping on the human face forever, Huxley's dystopia is the stuff of entertaining diversions, stage spectacles, and a cauterizing of the social imagination. The educational function of wider cultural apparatuses is now present in the new mechanisms of social planning and engagement found in the hallucinatory power of a kind of mind-deadening entertainment industry, the culture of extreme sports, and other forms of public pedagogy which extend from Hollywood movies and video games to mainstream television news and the social media. These cultural apparatuses are are the echo chambers that produce spectacles of extreme violence, representations of hyper-masculinity, the infantilization produced by consumer culture and frenzied shoppers, and the power of a fatuous celebrity culture encouraging the worship of lifestyles, all of which confers enormous authority on the likes of the rich and infamous, such as the dreadful Kardashians. As Huxley predicted, the memory of totalitarian methods of popular seduction, with its ready supply of simplistic answers, its vulgar spectacles, and its taste for massification, hawking fear, and its exploitation of the desire for strong leaders, has faded in a society beset by an amnesiac producing culture of immediacy, consumerism, and mindless spectacles. Under such circumstances, it's difficult to misjudge the depth and the tragedy of the collapse of civic culture and democratic public spheres. For those outside the influence of consumer culture, one that depoliticizes and infantilizes, there is a permanent war culture that trades in fear and paranoia concerning enemies at home and abroad, while maintaining the largest prison system in the world, with 2.2 million in jail and more than 4.8 million on parole. Another shocking and revelatory indication of the repressive fist of authoritarianism is in the Trump regime, took place when Trump's chief White House strategist, Steve Bannon, stated in an interview that the media should be embarrassed and humiliated and keep its mouth shut. This is more than an off-the-cuff angry comment. It's a blatant refusal to see the essential role of a robust and critical media in a democracy. How else to explain a U.S. president calling journalists among the most dishonest human beings in the world, quote unquote, going so far as to claim, quote, that the media are the enemy of the American people? These are ominous and alarming comments that not only suggest that journalists can be tried with treason, but also echo previous totalitarian regimes which wage war on both the press and democracy itself. As Roger Cohen observes, enemy of the people is a phrase with a near-perfect totalitarian pedigree, deployed with refinements by the Nazis, Stalin, and Mao. For Goebbels, writing in 1941, every Jew was a sworn enemy of the people. Hence the people. Here the people, rather, are an aroused mob, imbued with some mythical essence of nationhood or goodness by a charismatic leader. The enemy is everyone else. Citizenship, with its shared rights and responsibilities, has ceased to be. A public shaped by manufactured ignorance and indifferent to the task of discerning the truth from lies largely applauded this expression of totalitarian bravado, especially when it cites hatred and violence.
You're listening to Henry Giroux on Orwell, Huxley, and the New Authoritarianism. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org.
Trump's call to build a wall between the United States and Mexico and his consideration of using the National Guard to round up illegal immigrants arouses applause from his followers, as does Trump's penchant for disparaging all critics as losers, reminiscent of the ways failed contestants were treated on his reality TV show, The Apprentice. Dissenting journalists and others are refused access to government officials, derided as purveyors of fake news. They become objects of retribution while being told to shut up. And in the course of being symbolically fired, they're relegated to zones of terminal exclusion. Under the new authoritarian state, perhaps the greatest threat that one faces is not simply being subject to the dictates of arbitrary power, but when too few people seem interested in contesting such undemocratic use of power. It is precisely the poisonous and pervasive spread of political indifference that puts at risk the fundamental principles of justice and freedom which lie at the heart of any viable democracy. Trump's presidency signals the unimaginable. in that the democratic imagination has been transformed into a public relations machine that marshals its inhabitants into the neoliberal dream world of obedient subjects, babbling consumers, and armies of exploitive labor. This is the brave new surveillance punishing state that merges Orwell's Big Brother with Huxley's mind-altering modes of entertainment, education, and propaganda. The question now confronting us is, what will American society look like under a Trump administration? For those not marked by terminal exclusion and disposability, it may well mimic Huxley's nightmarish world in which corruption is rampant, ignorance is a political weapon, and pleasure is utilized as a form of control, of offering nothing more than the swindle of fulfillment, if not something more deluding and self-defeating. Both Huxley and Orwell presented their visions of closed dystopian societies as warnings, as critical frameworks to shake us out of our complacency, because they believed that avoiding a catastrophic future necessitated a more open society disinclined to model itself after the horrific images they so brutally imagined. Democracy in the United States is under siege, but the forces of resistance are mobilizing around a renewed consciousness in which civic courage and the ethical imagination are being realized once again through mass demonstrations in which individuals are putting their bodies on the line once again, refusing Trump's machinery of misogyny, nativism, and white supremacy. People are demonstrating in the streets of major cities. Town halls have become sites of resistance. Universities are being transformed into sanctuaries to protect undocumented students. And liberal and progressive politicians are speaking out against the emerging authoritarianism. Democracy may be in exile in the United States and imperiled in Europe and other parts of the globe, but the spirit that animates it is far from defeated. Once again, the public memory of prophecy is in the air, echoing Martin Luther King Jr.'s call to make real the promise of democracy. In what follows, I want to offer one strategy for resistance by developing what I call democracies in exile. The concept is intended to provide a rhetorical referent and material space that refuses the sense of expulsion, isolation, and punishment that derives from being metaphorically or materially barred from one's own country, and unites the ideal and promise of a substantive democracy with systemic forms of political engagement. It offers a model for critical consciousness in an ethical space where we can encounter the pain of others and truly reflect on its significance to a shared community. Such sanctuaries do more than simply offer refugees protection and services such as emergency shelters, recreation, public transit, libraries, food banks, and police and fire services without asking questions about their status. They also point to and beyond the identification of structures of domination and repression in search of a new understanding and imaginative response to the ominous forces at work in American society, marked by a collapse of civic culture, literacy, and shared citizenship. Such spaces constitute a new educational and political apparatus for people to learn together, to engage in extended dialogue, and to fashion political formations in the service of fighting for political, economic, and social justice. This radically expanded notion of sanctuary takes seriously that the fact that democracy cannot survive without informed citizens. Democracies in exile are grounded in a discourse of critique and hope, self-reflection, and a comprehensive understanding of politics. As a mode of critique, they offer spaces for critical dialogue, collaboration, and what it means to rethink the meaning of politics. As a discourse of hope, they offer the policy of organizing new levels of resistance designed to dismantle a society that is emulating totalitarian conditions given its attack on dissent. The social contract and individuals and groups who are being marked as deficient or disposable because of their religion, race, or country of origins. These models for democracy are open collectivities joined in the spirit of compassion and justice. They mark the antithesis of Trump's society of walls, punitive laws, and gated communities. They signal a mode of witnessing and organized resistance inspired by a renewed commitment to justice and equality. These zones of resistance offer an opportunity to fuse popular movements and traditional institutions such as unions, churches, and synagogues. Such outposts offer new models of collaboration united by a perpetual striving for a more just society. And as such, they join in solidarity and in their differences mediated by respect for the common good, human dignity, and decency. Together, they resist a demagogue and his coterie of reactionaries who harbor a rapacious desire for concentrating power in the hands of a financial elite and the economic and political religious fundamentalists who seek to amass power by any means necessary. This mode of opposition connects the task of both raising consciousness and mobilizing against the suffocating ideologies, worldviews, and policies that are driving the new authoritarianism. What might it mean to create a public sphere and institutions that represent models of a democracy in exile, sanctuaries that preserve the ideals, values, and experiences of an insurrectional democracy? What might it mean to imagine a landscape of resistance in which the metaphor of democracies in exile inspires and energizes young people, educators, workers, artists, and others to engage in political and pedagogical forms of resistance that are disruptive, transformative, and emancipatory? What might it mean to create multiple protective spaces of resistance that would allow us to think critically, ask troubling questions, take risks, transgress established norms, and fill the spaces of everyday life with ongoing acts of nonviolent opposition? What will it take to create entire cities whose diverse institutions function as sanctuaries for those who fear expulsion and state terror? How might we together generate modes of coordinated resistance that challenge this new and terrifying horizon of authoritarianism that has overshadowed the ideals of an already fragile and wounded democracy? The concept of democracies in exile is not a prescription or a rationale for cynicism, nor is it a retreat from one's role as an informed and engaged citizen. On the contrary, it's a space of energized hope where the realities of a new authoritarianism, along with its racist, morally obscene, and politically death-dealing practices, can be revealed, analyzed, challenged, and defeated. The United States now occupies an historical moment in which there will likely be an overwhelming acceleration of violence, oppression, lawlessness, and corruption. These are truly frightening times that must be confronted if a radical democratic future is not to be canceled out. There is no choice but to stop Trump's machinery of civil and social death from functioning. It has to be brought to an end in every space, landscape, and institution in which it tries to shut down the foundations of democracy. Reason and thoughtfulness have to awake from the narcotizing effects of a culture of spectacle, consumerism, militarism, and unchecked self-interest. The body of democracy is on life support, and the wounds now being inflicted upon it are alarming. This certainly raises questions about what role educational institutions should take in the face of the impending tyranny. One of the challenges facing the current generation of educators, students, progressives, and other concerned citizens is the need to address the role they might play in the face of such an authoritarianism. And at the heart of such efforts is the question of what education should accomplish in a democracy under siege. What work do educators have to do to create the political, ethical conditions necessary to endow young people and the general public with the capacities to think, to question, to doubt, to imagine the unimaginable and defend education as essential for inspiring and informed thoughts of citizenry integral to the existence of a robust democracy. In a world in which there is an increasing abandonment of egalitarian and democratic impulses and the erasure of historical memory, what will it take to educate young people in the broader polity to learn from the past and understand that the present, that the present and the present, in order to challenge authority and to hold power accountable? One option is for universities to become sanctuaries for democracies in exile. That would mean creating public spaces for the most vulnerable, illegal immigrants, and those deemed disposable, but also serve as a beacon for equipping students and others with the knowledge, the skills, the experiences, and the values that they need to participate in the struggle to keep the ideal and the practices of democracy alive. For many universities, this would mean renouncing their utterly instrumental approach to knowledge, empowering faculty to connect their work with important social issues, refusing to treat students as customers, choosing administrative leaders who have a vision rooted in the imperatives of ethics, justice, social responsibility, and democratic values. The culture of business has become the business of education. And to be frank, it has corrupted the mission of too many universities. It is necessary for students, faculty, and others to reverse this trend at a time when the dark shadows of authoritarianism are engulfing so much of the planet, threatening not only the spaces for critical inquiry, but democracy itself. We must ask, what role might education, historical memory, and critical pedagogy have in a larger society in which the social has become individualized? Political life has collapsed into the therapeutic, and education has been reduced to either a private affair or a kind of algorithmic mode of regulation in which everything is reduced to some kind of desired empirical outcome. That's not an argument against empirical evidence. That's an argument against empiricism. What role could a resuscitated critical education play in challenging the deadly neoliberal claim that all problems are individual, when the roots of such problems lie in larger systemic forces? What might it mean to enable people to learn how to translate private issues into public considerations? What might it mean to say that education in some fundamental way is about teaching people not how to simply be governed, but how to govern? What cannot be forgotten is that this is an authoritarian regime that we are now facing that draws from a fascist history that unleashed nothing short of large-scale terror, violence, and the death of the civic imagination. At the same time, it seems to me, any confrontation with the current historical moment has to be countered with a sense of hope and possibility, so that intellectuals, artists, workers, educators, and young people can imagine otherwise in order to act otherwise. Fortunately, diverse groups extending from union members and women's movement to other progressively oriented social formations such as the Moral Monday movement, the Block the Pipeline campaigns, along with a growing interest and a growing resistance by teachers, actors, and artists, are organizing to protest Trump's neo-fascist ideologies and policy. Optimism and sanity are in the air, and the urgency of mass action and the collective power of resistance has taken on a renewed relevance. What we are witnessing is a massive, broad-based struggle intent on producing forms of nonviolent resistance at all levels of society. We would do well to heed the words of the great abolitionist Frederick Douglass, who argues, "It's not the light that is needed, but fire. It's not the gentle shower, but thunder. We need the storm, the whirlwind, the earthquake. The feeling of the nation must be quickened. The conscience of the nation must be roused. The propriety of the nation must be startled. The hypocrisy of the nation must be exposed. And the crimes against God and man must be proclaimed and denounced. If there is no struggle, there is no progress. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will. We live at a time in which totalitarian forms are with us again. Hopefully, rage and anger will move beyond condemnation and demonstrations to develop a movement whose power will be on the side of justice, not injustice, bridges, not walls, compassion, not hate. Let's hope it develops into a worldwide movement capable of dispelling Orwell and Huxley's nightmarish vision of the future in our own time. The dark shadows of authoritarianism may be spreading, but it can be stopped. And that prospect raises serious questions about what educators, artists, youth, intellectuals, all of us can do to not succumb to the authoritarian forces circling American society and other parts of the globe. My friend, the late Howard Zinn, rightly insisted that hope is the willingness to hold out, even in times of pessimism, the possibility of surprise. To add to that, to this eloquent plea, I would say collective opposition is no longer an option. It's a necessity. Thank you.
How close are we to the slippery slope of fascism? And how susceptible are our values to the gravitational pull of our neighbor? What are the indications we should look for fascism here, and what can we do about it?
It's a terrific question. I mean, I think that, you know, fascism has, in many ways, though it tends to emerge in different forms, it has, there are certain consistencies that you begin to hear in the language. You know, you have entire peoples being demonized. You have the rise of the great savior. You know, you have a call that seems to suggest that a country is in such decline that we have to go back to a past, you know, when we could forget about indigenous people, when white people ruled, when in fact the systemic injustices that operated were really not as bad as they are today. We hear it in the call that somehow the attribute of violence has a cleansing effect in terms of what it might do to protect a society from what we might label as this decline. We hear it in the echo of the spectacles. You know, these spectacles that seem to suggest that dissent is somehow contaminated, that journalists are somehow evil, that universities are dominated by leftists, that religious fundamentalism really, in its most extreme forms, really provides the biblical values that will take us back to a time when a particular religious ideology was seen as acceptable for ruling a nation. It's a discourse against diversity. It's a discourse against justice. It's a discourse against the public good. It's a discourse that derides public services. It's a discourse that only speaks in privatized rights. It rarely ever speaks in ways that elevate the social to a notion that suggests that we have to have a profound kind of investment in what we might call the public good or in the commons. This is an argument, this is a discourse that does everything to concentrate power in the hands of a relatively financial and economic elite. And I think that I'm shocked when I listen to programs now, more recently in Canada, and I hear people invoking the language of totalized cultures, saying things like, well, you know, we need to protect our culture. You know, that's what Camus talked about. That's the language of the virus. That's a language that undercuts justice. That's a language that seems to suggest that diversity is a pathology. That's a language that, it seems to me, has to be resisted in every way. The second answer to that question is, what can we do? Is we've got to take civic literacy seriously. I mean, it matters to educate people to know about their history. It matters to educate people to know something about the injustices that informed it. It matters to educate people in terms of what's been left out. It matters to say that social responsibility is a virtue and not a liability.
Those of us who heard Mr. Trump speak were shocked, obviously. But the truth is, we have seen everything in what Trump said many times before. The problem is not that these things happen, but Americans don't know history. And they replay this history again and again. It is not new.
No, the issue, I think, is not that it's new. The issue is that it's moved from the margins of American society to the center of power. That's what's new.
I think it's a measure of the desperation that people have no roots, no ties.
I think that one of the things that I'm very concerned about, and I'm sure many of you are, is that, you know, we find ourselves increasingly in societies that are governed by shock-like values. You know, we're all part of a reality TV ethic in which the only person left is the one person on the island. We sort of lost what it means to talk about community. We've lost what it means to talk about shared values. We've lost what it means to talk about citizenship in a way that suggests that one cannot exist in a society without some sensitivity to the other. Couple that with massive inequalities in which time becomes a burden for many people, not a luxury. I have students in my class who work 40 hours a week. Time is a burden for them. You know, there are students who don't work, and time is more of a luxury for them. There are people who basically, to put it bluntly, are operating under what I call the emergency state of survival. And that's all they can do. They think, well, they make decisions like, what does it mean to either eat or have medicine for my children? What does it mean to not have a job and all of a sudden to blame myself? What does it mean to live in a society where you have a party of extremists who are cutting away every social provision that matters? And when they do so, they say that the people who basically need those provisions are either lazy, stupid, or ignorant. It seems to me the educational apparatus, if we don't have a language, if we don't have possibilities for critique, if we don't have spaces to support people to engage in that critique, then public trust, public values, and social justice die. Democracies die. Dewey was right. He was right on these issues. You can't have a democracy without informed citizens. And I think one of the great problems we have seen, both particularly on the left and not on the right, is that the left, in many ways, believes that all forms of domination are basically structural, economic. And what they have failed to realize is that education is at the center of politics. You have to change consciousness in order to enable people to, in some way, be able to identify in the language that they're hearing the very conditions in which they find themselves. That takes time. I'm not going to call Trump supporters stupid. I think that's offensive. What I believe is that's a pedagogical challenge. I want to know how they got there. I want to know why they believe that. I want to know how that in some way functions in a way that's at odds with reality. I want to know why that investment seems so desperate and what are the conditions that drive it. Shame is bad pedagogical political practice. It doesn't work. I mean, what we need to do is we need to talk to each other, provide the spaces where people can listen and take seriously what it means to live in a country in which literacy basically is the basis for not only changing conscience, but making sure that the flame of justice and democracy stays alive, because it's always a struggle. That struggle is non-ending. There's no period at the end of the sentence when we talk about democracy. It just keeps going. We have a responsibility for every generation, from librarians to university presidents to deans to faculty, to make sure that we say to students, look, we don't believe in just short-term investments. We believe in long-term investments. It's not just the bottom line. It's also about making an investment in your generation so your future can be better than our future. So you can be equipped to look back at an older generation and say, they provided the guidepost for us. We're not alone. We're not overburdened by debt. We're not overburdened with not having jobs. We're not overburdened by a culture of immediacy and idiocy that we can't work through, that we don't know how in some way to come together in acts of solidarity with people who are black, brown, and other, and realize that we all bleed together, to use that metaphor. We bleed together. Democracy is not a society inhabited by isolated individuals. It's a society inhabited by collectives of people who share respect for their differences and more. Thank you very much.
That was Henry Giroux on Orwell, Huxley, and the New Authoritarianism. He spoke at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. Professor Giroux teaches at McMaster. He's written many books, including Neoliberalism's War on Higher Education and America at War with Itself. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization, Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, Naomi Klein, Richard Wolff, Jonathan Kozel, Chris Hedges, and Noam Chomsky. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs, MP3s, or written transcripts of today's program, Henry Giroux on Orwell, Huxley, and the New Authoritarianism, call us at 1-800-444-1977. That number again is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
This is 88.5 WMNF Tampa, homegrown, hand-picked music and news. Stay tuned following NPR News for Dan Ruth, hosting Midpoint today.